It's great to be here tonight. I have really enjoyed this this commitment and the people in the Winston-Salem area, this particular group. I've been to AA in a lot of different places, and this is good AA, good warm, friendly clubhouse type AA, and I so appreciate it. I want to start off tonight reading something from the pamphlet Problems Other Than Alcohol. This pamphlet was written by Bill W. It's been changed over the years, but he basically wrote this himself to address certain issues. But what I want to read is just a couple of sentences from it. This is on like page 2 of the pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcohol. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. Groups have repeatedly tried other activities and they have always failed. The teaching and practice of the 12 steps is the sole purpose of any AA group. This is probably an area where a lot of contemporary Alcoholics Anonymous groups fall short. They're not teaching and they're not practicing the 12 steps the way maybe some of the earlier members back in the day would have done it. If to thoroughly follow the path allows us to rarely fail, then teaching and practicing that path should be very, very important to us. Yet Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of meetings that I've gone to, especially up around the Northeast, really fail to even use the recovery process as a topic sometimes. A lot of times the topics are things that are kind of irrelevant to a solution to alcoholism. And again, when I showed up in North Carolina, I was really, really pleased. Practically every meeting I've gone to has been solution-based. And I think you've got a higher degree of survivability if you're an alcoholic and you landed a meeting in North Carolina than in a lot of other places. I've been to AA in many other countries, and there are countries that are actually hostile to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. A few European countries basically make the statement that the big book movement so prevalent in America is for our particular case outside the scope of RAA. There's two countries that I know of that actually make that statement. And when you think about it, how do you take the basic text out of a society that's based on it? It doesn't make any sense. It would be like saying, you can come into this calculus class, but don't be bringing your textbook with you. We don't want you quoting any facts and figures. We just want your opinion on calculus. It wouldn't make any sense. And so there are some countries that really need to gain a little bit of maturity to get to the point where they're going to be efficacious for alcoholics that show up. They're going to be a place where the alcoholics can really find a solution. Now, last week we went over step 5. I'm going to pick it up down here on the bottom of page 75 into action. Returning home, this is what I stopped with. There's an exercise after you do the fifth step, and it's called the returning home exercise. And that's basically where we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, and we do a guided meditation. And what that guided meditation is about is we need to ask ourselves, are we covering everything? Are we being thorough with this recovery process? Did we leave anything out of step 4 or step 5? Do we really believe that we're an alcoholic? Do we really believe that there's a solution and that there's a power greater than ourselves that we can hook into? Did we really make a decision to go after the connection with that higher power? And when I'm working the steps with somebody, what I'll usually do is I'll usually say, look, if during your meditation you come up with anything that that you were, you know, you didn't put in your fourth step. You didn't tell me in the fifth step. If there's anything that you have any questions with, I'll be available on the phone. Because sometimes it's rare, but sometimes in the quiet hour, some people will come up with something that, you know, they had left out, or they'll get the courage to finally share the thing. You know, a lot of us have in our fifth step the thing, you know, and that's the thing that we just really are going to have a hard time admitting. And you know, to get past that is really, really a good thing. I'm going to move on to top of page 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction that we've done the absolute best we can with the first five steps, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. In other words, in the third step, we really became willing to go to any lengths. We were shown what any lengths were by this book. One of the things that I have a problem with is before I knew what was going on, people were asking me, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I didn't know what any lengths looked like. You know, I'm wondering, well, what does that mean? Am I going to have to sell flowers at the airport, you know? Well, what is that? Am I going to have to be celibate for the next 50 years? What exactly does that mean? And again, a lot of times what we need to do is we need to offer our prospects or the people that we're working with, offer them the dignity of understanding what any lengths means. And that's covered in the next chapter, which is basically working with others. Before we start taking people through the steps, we're to have them read this volume. And then we can ask them, are you willing to go to any lengths? Because they're going to then know what any lengths looks like. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things that, which we have admitted are objectionable? This is a question. This is a step six question. Now, it's pretty easy to say yes to this, especially when we've just gone through step four and step five. In step four, we've listed out every character defect, every problem, every issue that we have. We've you know, filled that out in step four, and then we've shared it in step five. It's right in front of our face, these things that caused our failure at life, the things that we're ashamed of, the things that we really wish we hadn't done. They're all staring us right in the face because we've just done a step four and a step five. So when we ask ourselves, are we ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable, it's easy to say yes. But like a lot of steps, we can only take it where we can take it now. Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. This is basically step six. If we're hanging on to anything, that's okay. We can continue to move forward, but we need to start to ask God for the willingness to let that particular thing go. I want to tell a story that kind of illustrates this. At a certain level, we are ready to let God remove defects of character from us. Okay, the things that cause us harm, we're ready to let go of. But there's some other things that we may not be completely willing to deal with right now. And I'm going to tell a story that kind of illustrates this. Little Joey, he's maybe about 6 years old, okay? He starts to get a toothache. Now, he knows if he goes to his mother and says, "Mom, I've got a toothache," what will happen is he'll get the aspirin crushed up. He'll be given the aspirin. He'll be maybe put to bed early, and the toothache will go away. He understands that. But he doesn't go to his mother and tell his mother that he's got a toothache. What happens is he tries to keep it to himself. He tries to just, you know, hopefully it'll go away. And it's about 10 o'clock at night and he's in bed and he still can't sleep. And now he's finally got to go up and he's got to get out of bed and go tell his mother he's got a toothache and it hurts. Now, why didn't he tell her right away? He knows that he would get the aspirin that would take away the toothache. Well, the reason he didn't go to his mother right away, because he knows that, yes, the toothache will go away, but tomorrow morning there'll be a call made to Dr. Mengele, the dentist. And he's going to be shuffled off to the dentist, and he's going to go in there, and he's going to be strapped down in the seat, and, you know, there's going to be drills and suction and pokers and smoke and blood. And, you know, finally, after 2 or 3 hours, he's going to get out of that dentist chair, and he's going to have perfect teeth. Okay, he knows he's going to have perfect teeth. But that's why he doesn't tell his mother, because he doesn't want perfect teeth. He just wants the toothache to go away. And a lot of times that's us. We don't want to be perfect people. We just don't want to have problems anymore. You know what I mean? So we can take this step at a certain level, yes. But we need to remember that the things that we're not willing to let go of, we need to pray for the willingness to let go of them. Agnosticism is basically this. Ag means none, and gnosis means knowledge. So basically, agnosticism means we just don't have any knowledge of. Current agnosticism, as it can be applied in Alcoholics Anonymous, is basically not believing that God will work in this specific area of your life. God will not bring you to a better place in this specific area of your life. In other words, if I let God in and start to try to get direction from God about my job, they'll step all over me because it's a battlefield out there. I'm in sales. I can't be a wuss. You know, I've got to be an animal out there. You know, so I'm not gonna follow spiritual principles at work. You know, that's agnosticism, not believing that God is going to take you to a better place. How about your sex life? I don't know about you, but I wasn't real happy to say, okay, you know, God's going to now be in charge of my sex life. I was worried I'd never get laid again if God was going to be in charge of my sex life, you know? Hold on a minute here. Let's not go crazy with this stuff. You know what I mean? But that's current agnosticism. How do I know? You know what? If I'm not willing to let God direct me in that area, how do I know? How do you know what you don't know? So if I'm not willing to let God in on my work or my sex life or whatever, family life, whatever, then I need to be willing to ask to be willing, and that's really step six. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step seven. Understand, we're moving through this stuff pretty quickly. Now, do you just go right through step six and seven and take about a minute and a half with it and never look back on it? I don't believe so. I believe step six and step seven are part of a lifetime process. I think I get put in front of my character defects. I get put in front of the selfishness and the self-centeredness that I still have, because it's not completely removed. I get put in front of that all the time. So I am going to be facing these character defects, and I'm going to be facing becoming willing to have God remove them and then humbly asking God to remove them for quite some time. But initially, as I go through the steps, I can move through these fairly quickly. A mistake I made when I was going through the steps the first time, and I didn't have any clear guidance. In my area, that you just kind of winged it. When it was time for you to go through the steps, you just kind of winged it, because really nobody knew what they were doing. AA in my area had devolved into a fellowship of sobriety and forgotten that it's actually a program of recovery. It just had. And so I decided after I did my first fifth step that I would work on my character defects. Has anybody in here ever done that? worked on your character defects? How'd that work out for you? You know, I believe I'm powerless over my character defects, just like I'm powerless over alcohol. If I could just decide to be unselfish, I would have probably tried it a long time ago. If I could have gotten rid of my anger or my anxiety or any other number of character defects or issues that I had, I probably would have done so a long time ago. I'm not stupid. I knew that these character defects were causing me problems in my life, but I couldn't seem to get away from them. You know, has anybody in here ever seen the game Whack-A-Mole?
Yeah.
They take a mallet and a mole's head will stick up and you'll try to whack that mole, but the mole will drop down, another one will pop over here, you go over here trying to, another one's popping up over here. That's what it was like with me trying to work on my character defects. You know, one day I'd say, I'm not going to be selfish today. You know, I'd make it about an hour and a half until I got in front of somebody, and then I'd be selfish. You know, well, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. And I was struggling to try to become a better person, and it just didn't work. What I was doing was I was just whacking the mole. And my sponsor told me one time, Chris, if you keep whacking the mole, you could go blind. So, understand that you don't have the power to recreate yourself. This is not a self-help program. This is a God-help program. When you see this book in the self-help section, you know, that's the wrong place for it. Because if we could have helped ourselves, we would have done so a whole lot longer ago than now. You know what I mean? What this is we lack the power. We don't lack the intelligence. We don't lack the fortitude. You know, we don't lack the desire. We lack the power. Lack of power is our dilemma. So we need to capture that power. We need to get close to that power. We need to align ourselves with that power so that the recreation of our life can start to take place. And if you read the 12 and 12, the 12 and 12 is very, very good with step 6 and 7. There's a lot of expanded ideas in the 12 and 12. I still think it's very simple to take these steps. But I like what Bill writes in there. He writes a lot about humility. Humility really being defined for what we see it as in Alcoholics Anonymous. Humility being an accurate self-appraisal. Not seeing yourself as less than what you are. Not seeing yourself as more than what you are. An accurate self-appraisal. Now, my last drunk started somewhere around December 24th, 1989. And it lasted till somewhere around December 28th, 1989. It was like a 5-day drunken blackout, and it was absolutely horrible. And what happened to me was, when I was going through the DTs, I got to a point where I couldn't live with alcohol anymore. I couldn't live without it. I had to stop drinking. If you're alcoholic, you understand what I mean. There comes times when you just have to sober up. And I'm in the process of separating from alcohol and going through all the DTs and everything that involved. And I remember laying back on a couch and you know, I'm hallucinating, and I saw a demon come out of the ceiling. This demon was coming down to eat my face. It was like a big bull head. You know, I could see the snot coming out of its nose. I mean, this was real, you know. I'm sitting there hallucinating. And I screamed. God help me! Like, you know, like just from the depths of my soul, you know, this moved me. It scared me to death. I thought this thing was going to drag me off to hell. I really did. And I screamed in utter desperation, God, please help me. And I haven't had a drink since then. You know, that was the last drink of alcohol I had, was prior to that experience. Now, I believe God hears these prayers. I believe that there's a connection between our ability to move away and separate from something. I believe that there's a connection to our desperation and our humility and our honesty and accessing the power that allows us to do so. Does that make any sense? Now, I think in the 12 and 12, Bill is kind of asking us to look at our character defects like we would look at our alcohol. Yes, God separated from us from alcohol, but can He separate us from some of these grosser handicaps, I believe, is kind of what it says in that book. And I believe that we need to look at separating from these character defects with the same kind of humility. We can't go into this thinking that we can do it. You know, it's my job. I'm just going to do a better job. That's not humble. That's not from humility. Humility would basically be admitting our defeat. If we could have done better with these things, wouldn't we have? You know, we're not stupid. We don't lack intelligence. We lack power. So we're going to God, asking God for the power. You know, help me with this stuff, because I can't seem to do it on my own. I can't seem to become a better person. I can't seem to grasp this spiritual living the way I should. I keep retreating back into selfishness and self-centeredness. Help me. Now, there are many people in here who are parents, right? Everybody in here kind of understands what it's like to be a parent. If you don't, you understand what it's like to be a kid. Think for a minute. Let's say you had a young son about 8 years old, and that young son came up to you and said something like this: "Dad or Mom, listen, I know I haven't been a very good kid. I know that I could have done a better job, I should have done a better job with a lot of things. I know that I'm a little selfish and, I don't do enough of the things that I need to do. Would you help me to be a better kid? Could I come to you for guidance and direction on what I should be doing and how I should be doing it? Can I rely upon you to help me become a better kid?" What wouldn't you do for a child that would come up to you and say something like that? You know, it's probably unheard of, something like that happening. Yeah. But what would you not do for your child if they came to you with that kind of humility? Really, honestly wanting to just be a better kid. I think that's what it's like when we go to God with this stuff. God, help us be a better person. When you look at the prayer for step 7, it's a selfless prayer. We're asking that God remove the defects of character that stand in the way of our usefulness to God and to our fellows, not the things that bother us. It's a very selfless prayer. And I believe this stuff happens. My first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was terrified. I had social anxiety phobia like you wouldn't even believe. I sat in the meetings hoping nobody would call on me, scared to absolute death of raising my hand and sharing. And I actually started forcing myself to go to meetings where they went around the room, because I knew I had to learn to share. I knew that that was necessary, so I put myself in meetings where they would call on me. And then when I finally started raising my hand to share, it was like this, "Oh, my name's Chris." My self-esteem was just so shot. I was just so, I had such anxiety about talking in front of more than one or two people. Now that almost got removed right away, moving through this step work, because it blocked me off from God and my fellow man. How am I going to be any good at all if I can't even talk? So that's one of the character defects that got removed. But there were other character defects that I wanted to be removed, and I was praying for them to be removed. But maybe I wasn't willing, or maybe it wasn't quite time. You know, I don't think any of us become perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of glad of that, because I don't know about you, but I don't really like perfect people. You ever met somebody that's perfect? It's horrible. You know? I mean, so seriously, a lot of times it's our imperfections that make us lovable. So the defects of character that get removed are not always the ones that we want removed when we want them removed. We still have to participate in this process and let God decide, you know, what's going to change and what isn't. And what we have to do is we have to stay in the right spiritual atmosphere for these changes, these defects of character to be removed. And the best possible spiritual atmosphere to be in for the removal of your character defects is to become willing to make direct amends to the people and institutions where your character defects have caused harm. And then actually go out and make direct amends to the people and institutions that your character defects have harmed. Now, you know, this isn't something that I was really looking forward to, you know, when I first came into AA and saw the steps up on the wall. I'm like, you know, make direct amends to all those people? You have got to be kidding me. How is that relevant, you know? It's relevant in a very, very important and powerful way. I want to tell the story of a guy I sponsor, and I got a call from him today. I don't hear from him much anymore, but he's still doing great. He's working with other alcoholics. The call was not about him. It was about, you know, this guy that I'm working with. How should I handle this? You know, he's just a great, great AA. He's also an NA member, and, you know, he's also a really strong church member, and his whole life is about, you know, helping people. And when I was first working with him, I'm actually coming out of a store. We went into a store before a meeting, and I saw him pocket something, you know. And when we get outside, I'm like, what? You stole something? You put something in your pocket? And he's like, no. I'm like, you took something. You took something from the 7-Eleven and put it in your pocket. What'd you do? He goes, oh, that was the stuff in the front. I'm like, what do you mean it's the stuff in the front? He goes, oh yeah, you know, they put it there. They got budgets. They know you're going to take it. I'm like, Dad, no. You stole. He goes, oh, I've been doing that my whole life. I'm like, I want you to go home and I want you to think about what you were doing. And he comes back, he's, listen, he's a good AA, he's working through the steps with me, and he comes to the conclusion that yes, it was stealing. You know, it was a mild form of stealing, but it was stealing. And because he was willing to go to any lengths, he became willing to go and make amends to all of these stores that he had stolen from. So we got a list together of all the stores, and he made a value judgment. This guy's making a lot of money. It's like the biggest Mason in New Jersey, you know, so he's making a lot of money. So we put together how much he probably stole from all these places, and he went around and he started paying these places back. You know, I've been stealing for 20 years, you know, off your front counter. Here's some money. You know, and he went around and he made direct amends to all these places. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think he still steals when he goes into 7-Elevens? No way. This experience has changed him. The best possible spiritual atmosphere that you can be in for the removal of a character defect is to become willing to make amends where that defect has caused harm, and actually go out and make amends where that defect of character has caused harm. This shows God, you know, a level of humility that just by saying, God, you know, keep me out of the jackpot, does not. You know, you're willing to take action, and it's that action that enables you to recreate your life. All right, let's start reading. Let's read a little bit about step 8 here. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. There's a transitional sentence or so in between every step, and it's always pushing us forward. It's always next we launched, or now, right here it says we need more action, or because faith without works is dead. In other words, just thinking about this stuff, we will die. We need to actually take action on this stuff. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have listed all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. A lot of times back in the day, when I was getting sober, sponsors or people that you did fifth steps with told you to burn the fifth step when you were done with it. Okay, as soon as you do the fifth step, you know, burn it and the ashes can go up to God. Well, you're kind of screwed when you get to step eight if you burned your inventory. Because you're using a lot of the material off of it to put together your eighth step list. Where does it come from? It comes from column 4 in the resentment inventory. Where were you selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? It comes from the fear inventory of basically who did you harm by having the fear. You need to look at all your fears to see who was in the line of fire, who suffered because you had those fears. And then in the harms to others, the sex inventory, answering those 9 questions. Who did we hurt? You know, how did we hurt them? We can take all of that information and turn it into an 8-step list. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We at least attempt to repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, if we still have a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of anxiety about going back to old bosses, you know, old boyfriends or girlfriends, going back to, you know, ex-wives or ex-husbands, or going back to friends that we screwed over, or places that we stole from or robbed from or whatever, if we still have trepidation about that, if we haven't the will to do that, we ask until it comes. So if you're not willing to make complete amends to them all, you're supposed to start a prayer regimen. You're supposed to every single day, probably twice a day, ask God to become willing to make amends for these defects of character. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And sometimes these lengths are needed. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident. We may feel uncomfortable about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them at the moment we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Remember, we're trying to move away from a foundation built on selfishness and self-centeredness to a foundation built on love and service. That's the only way for us to survive this unbelievably aggressive illness known as alcoholism that kills 90% of the people who have it by drinking themselves to death. Okay, this is a serious illness. And the only aggressive enough treatment is the steps. And that means actually going out and making amends. One of the things that I ask people who aren't really willing to do these amends are, is it possible if you don't do these amends, alcohol can go back in your body? Is it possible? Sometimes I need to ask myself that. Sometimes it needs to be as black and white as this. Do the amends, die an alcoholic death. One or the other. Which one do I want to do? You know, sometimes doing the amends sometimes doing the amends is nothing compared to putting alcohol back in my body and seeing demons come out of the ceiling to eat my face. I'll go and I'll do the amends. But a lot of times we just kind of shy away from this stuff. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the early days of AA, when this book was written, all of the members were in the Oxford group or just leaving the Oxford group. The Oxford group was a religious organization. It was very, very much a Christian organization. So a lot of the early examples of amends were basically people going and saying, you know, I've had a conversion experience. I'm now a Christian, and I'm trying to change my life. Bill is kind of saying that maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe we need to be basically saying that we were wrong and we want to change our life and leave the religious stuff out of it. I think a lot of times people will be more apt to respect our approach if we're just trying to set right the wrong, rather than we've had some conversion experience, you know, and we want to change. A lot of times they'll think we're a crackpot. But if we go back and we actually let them know that we need to amend the way we have been living, we need to make restitution, we need to try to set right the wrong, because that's very important to us now because we want to live in a different way, a lot of times people will respect this. It says in this book that 9 times out of 10, the unusual, you know, the unexpected will happen. We'll be shown a very, very generous response. And I know that that's been my experience too. So if we go there on a religious basis, it says in the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. Now, I understand that sentence now from experience. I've made some amends that have later translated into an ability to help. I'll tell the story of one of them right now. I had to make direct amends to a niece. This was somebody who would experience me drinking whenever she would visit with her mother over Christmas or Thanksgiving or whatever. You know, Chris would be drunk out of his mind. And there was something about her I didn't like. She reminded me of myself, is really what it was. You know what I mean? And she had character defects that were like mine. And you know, there's nothing worse than having a mirror shoved up in your face. So I would say things to my niece that an uncle just shouldn't say. I had an attitude toward her which was really unfair. So as I'm doing my fourth step, as I'm putting my eighth step list together, it becomes very apparent I need to make direct amends to my niece. Okay, I make direct amends one day, and basically what I do is I list out everything I'm clear on that I was wrong about. The things that I did to her that were wrong. And she just couldn't believe it. She couldn't even talk. She's like, you know, no one has ever done this to me before. I don't even know what to say. She really was blown away because, you know, I had a sense of humility about all this. Now, about a month or two goes by, and all of a sudden I get a phone call. And guess who it is? It's my niece. She's in a psychiatric hospital after trying to take her own life with a drug overdose. And who did she call? Did she call her mother? No. Did she call her father? No. She called me because she knew I would understand. That never would have happened if I didn't make amends to her. And basically what happened was, you know, I told her, you need to seek professional help. And she had a very abusive father, a real sick father that she grew up with. He would try to scare her by doing this. If you don't behave, I'm going to take you to the head shrinkers! And scared her to death by thinking that these psychiatrists were going to just torture her, you know? And so she was balking at this. And I was able to say, no, listen, you know, I've had counseling myself. Don't worry about it. You're actually going to probably enjoy it if you get a counselor that you can relate to. And she started counseling, and she was in counseling for years. And now she's doing great. She moved away from all of those things that were dragging her down. And that probably wouldn't have happened if I didn't make direct amends to her. So, you know, when it says in here that we may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, we always need to remember to try to do these amends right and leave the line of communication open. Because a number of times when I've done amends, those people that I did amends to called me up later for help, whether it was for themselves or someone they knew. They understood that there was somebody out there who was in the process of recovering from alcoholism who had an answer. And I became I became helpful. I became helpful. So you never know where these amends are going to go. Our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. So a lot of times what we need to do is we need to keep this focused on setting right the wrong. And not getting involved in a lot of the other stuff. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of if somebody asks you, what's going on? You can say, I'm trying to live a spiritual life. And if they start asking you questions, you can get deeper and deeper into it as it's appropriate. As it's appropriate for each person that you're talking to, with tact and common sense. Today I have no problem telling people that I have certain disciplines, certain prayer and meditative disciplines that where I try to capture the will of God, whatever that might be, whether I try to figure out what God's will would be for me each day, and then ask for the strength and direction to carry that out. That's how I try to live my life today. I'm not afraid to tell anybody that, but I'm not just going to go up to my boss, and say, "Oh, you know what I do?" They're gonna probably promote somebody else if I do that. So you need to use tact and common sense. Now, there's a whole bunch of different type of amends. We're going to start with how to approach the man we hate, okay? Looking back on our resentment inventories, there's going to be a number of people on our resentment inventories that we need to approach with amends. And here's what it says about that. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be that he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. How about this? I think we all have one of these. Usually when I sit somebody down and they come over and they're starting to put together an 8-step list, what usually happens is there's people that they point out to me that I don't care what you say, I am never going to make amends to this son of a bitch. I don't even know why I put him on the list. I put him on the list just to be thorough. But I don't want to be giving you the impression that I'm ever going to make amends to this son of a bitch. A lot of times we have these, all right? I want to tell a story. This is my favorite sponsee. I do big book workshops all over the planet with this guy, okay? He had one of these, and when he's going through the steps with me, he did that. He pointed this out. He goes, "You know what this guy did? This guy sexually molested my underage daughter. If you think I'm going to be making amends to him, you're wrong." I said, okay. Let's do the amends you're willing to do now. He had about 60 amends. He does 59 of them. And he calls me up and he goes, "God damn it." He goes, "I got this one amends left. I got to come over. I got to talk to you about this. And he comes over to my house. He goes, "What am I going to do? I got to do this." He saw that by doing 59 amends, he saw what happened in his life. And he also knew that hanging on to that one was going to corrode his spiritual condition. So what he did, we sat down and we said, look, this guy's a jerk. You had him prosecuted. You actually showed up at his house and beat him senseless in front of his family. Okay, this was an in-law family member. He went over, he beat him near to death, and he prosecuted him and everything. I mean, this was a big scene years ago in his life. So I go, "Look, what he did was wrong. Let's look at this closely. What exactly are you going to be making amends for?" You don't want the guy back in your life. You don't want to have him back at the Christmas parties. I understand that. You know, but you need to heal. You need to heal. So what he did was he put together an approach, and then he put together a specific amends. And he met with this guy at a neutral location at like a Denny's or something. And the guy came with all his paperwork. He wanted to show how he really wasn't guilty or anything. And my buddy said, no, I'm not here to discuss anything about you. I'm here to discuss about me. What I did with hatred in my heart. And I was wrong. I was wrong for having that hatred in my heart. I can't live like that anymore. I just want you to know that I don't hate you anymore. And this basically was his amends. When he beat him up, he did it with hatred in his heart. When he had him prosecuted, he did it with hatred in his heart. He had to make amends for that. And he walked away from this Denny's the freest man I've ever seen in recovery. This guy has been bulletproof. He is a go-to guy in North Jersey as far as a sponsor is concerned. He takes the time to get you through the steps, and the people that walk away from him after going through the steps, every one of them stays sober. Every one of them has a quality of life that's out. This guy is like the Buddha of sponsors. And he got that strength, he got that spiritual strength by doing this really hard work, like going and making an amends to somebody who had really harmed one of his children. You know, it doesn't make any sense until you actually do this stuff. And then you find freedom like you cannot believe. Why in the world would he want to be attached to this guy, whether it's through hatred or resentment? Why would he want to be attached to this guy the rest of his life? By actually making amends for his part, he finds freedom from the guy. He doesn't have to think about the guy anymore. The guy is a non-event in his life from now on. And he doesn't have that poison pill in the back of his mind just causing that corrosion to your spiritual condition. You know, that I think is what this is about. This step is about freedom. How free do you want to be? Is the question we need to ask ourselves when it comes to this stuff. Nevertheless, with the person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. What that means is we just go and we do it. We don't want to do it. We're probably scared about doing it. We've got a lot of anxiety. We take the bit in our teeth and we just go do it. And a lot of times I have a special prayer that I say before these amends, because I don't know about anybody else, but amends really affect me emotionally. I'm always worried about doing them. So I'll do like a little meditation, like God in, fear out. God in, fear out. I'll do that for about 5 minutes, and then I'll get up, I'll get out of the car, I'll take the bit in my teeth, and I'll go knock on the door. And I'll just do it. And I know that I've got God on my side. Yes, it's scary. Yes, a lot of times we've got all kinds of anxiety. But this is about freedom. This is about recovery from alcoholism. This is about survival. And this is about having an incredible quality in our life without having that corroding thread of resentment and fear. We're trying to move away from that. It says here it is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. Yeah, we can do the friend amends. You know, we forgot to pay somebody back $20 or stuff. Ah, yeah, here's your $20. Oh, I forgot all about that. You know, those are easy. Going to the person who harmed our children, I mean, that is hard, but we find it much more beneficial to us to do those type of amends. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. That's an instruction. Our former ill feeling, expressing our regret. We're trying to live life on a different basis now. We're trying to live it without hate, without resentment. We understand that resentment kills us. We understand that anger is a dubious luxury of people who can't afford it, and alcoholics are not people who can afford anger and resentment. So we need to take action to get rid of them. A lot of times just, you know, praying for the bastard is not enough. We've got to go and we've got to face these individuals. I'm gonna stop tonight with a story. There was a guy who I became very, very friendly with. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is basically discovering some Joe and Charlie tapes back around 1991, 92. Slowly these tapes changed the way I dealt with Alcoholics Anonymous because I heard so much truth and you know, so much experience coming from these tapes. It changed the way I approached Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to approach Alcoholics Anonymous like it was a program of recovery instead of a fellowship of sobriety. Now, what happened was I needed to make an amends. I had trashed a house in college. Really, really drunk one night. The cops were called and, you know, we got thrown out of this house. And I was really pissed that we got thrown out of this house. So I had a house trashing party the next night. You know, they gave us like a week to get out. So I'm having a house. We ripped the doors off of this house and put a big bonfire in the backyard. You know, we broke everything, punched holes in the walls, trashed this house. I got up on the roof and kicked the chimney over. You know, I mean, we trashed this house. And you know, I'm basically remembering all this, and I've got to put this on an 8-step list. And what happened was, I could not find this family. They were an elderly couple that did not have any children, and I could, they had died by the time it was time for me to make amends. I just couldn't find them. I hired the private investigators. I did the online searches. They were nowhere to be found. I called up 70 families with their last name in that state, and I could not find anybody that even knew who they were. But I had to get that money back out into the universe. You know, I had to set the scale right. So I decided what I was going to do was I was going to make copies of these Joe and Charlie tapes. And I made about 200 copies of this Joe and Charlie workshop, which was 8 tapes for the whole workshop. And I started to pass them around. Now, I passed them around to this one guy who, you know, he responded. Most people couldn't have cared less about this stuff. But this one guy really responded to it. He and I became fast friends, and we started to do big book workshops together. And somewhere along the line, he started to dislike me. I'm sure I played a part in it. I'm sure I did. I've never been clear on exactly where that was. But he started to dislike me, and he started to talk behind my back. He started to tell people to stay away from me because, you know, I was going to get drunk and all this stuff. And then these people would come to me and say, Chris, you know, this guy's saying you're going to get drunk. And I would go up to him, and I'd go, well, why are you telling these people I'm going to get drunk? Why don't you talk to me? If you see a problem, you know, why aren't you talking to me? Oh, I'm not telling anybody anything. And, you know, the guy just ended up being kind of psychotic. Well, you know, it got worse and worse and worse. And finally, I had done a fifth step with this guy. And he started telling everybody all this stuff that was on my fifth step and that I was going to get drunk because this is stuff that he heard on my fifth step. And one day, my ex-wife was getting her hair cut, and the barber, the hairdresser, started talking about these things that had happened with me that I shared on my fifth step. And she's like, oh, and it concerned other women, you know. And so I, she comes back and she yells at me. So I call up the hairdresser. I go, where the hell did you hear that? Oh, so and so told me. So now he's like going around sharing my fifth step stuff. Now I get pissed. Okay? I get pissed. I have a justified resentment. This is justified because he's attacking me for no reason in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, what happened was I gathered my troops and I started talking to everybody about this guy. You wouldn't believe what he's doing to me. And, you know, I started to talk to his sponsees and say, almost like we're forming teams. You know, who's right? And I'm winning. At least I think. Now the problem is I'm dying inside because of this resentment. I am dying inside. And I'm Mr. Big Book. I'm the guy that goes around and tells tells everybody how to work the steps. And I'm dying of a resentment. You know, made me look bad. So what happened was I got to a point where I knew I had to face this. So I call him up. I set up the meeting. And it ended up being like a double amends. But I was able to basically share with this guy that I was wrong. And I took this very personally. You know, I talked bad behind your back. I did this. And I shared that with him. And this was somebody I couldn't stand. Every night I was thinking about how I could murder this guy. Now, after I made these amends with him, it became a non-event. I found complete freedom from this resentment. Now, I may have only had 5% of this issue. 5% of the wrong might have been mine, and 95% might have been his. But I have to take 100% of my 5% to get free of it. And that's basically what I did. And I found through that experience that it's harder to go to the person you hate, but it's much more beneficial. I found that I could find freedom from this hatred I have toward people. I found a way out, and praying for the bastard wasn't cutting it. I had to actually face this man and take responsibility for my part. This stuff works, folks. Do not shortchange yourself. Do not shortchange yourself and be in Alcoholics Anonymous and not get the meat of the whole thing. Please. That's all I got for tonight. Thanks.